Howdy-do, my Inklings, and welcome back to Catawampus Readings, the podcast where beginnings and introductions are mourned when we have to bury them before their time. I don't know if any of you realized this back when you were in school, or if you're still in school and have thought of this on your own, but it was pointed out to me when I was about 10 years old that there are a lot of books about dogs that end with the death of the dog. After that, I was dead set on never reading another dog book. Pun completely intended. Horse books were a lot safer since the horse almost never dies. Not even in books like Black Beauty or The War Horse, which explicitly address death. And if you think about it, books like White Fang, Where the Red Fern Grows, Sounder, and of course the book we're looking at today, Old Yeller, form a solid core to the dog book category. And at the end of each book, the dog or dogs die. Even if there are other books in the same category where the dog doesn't die, these foundational works kind of set the tone for everything else. And as depressing as that is, and as much as we all know I hate reading depressing stories, is it really worth it to read a book you know is going to be sad? I would venture a suggestion that the answer is yes, but maybe not under all circumstances. There are a lot of reasons to read, after all, and while those books that make us cry can teach us things, there are some situations, moods, or even stages of life when dealing with grief over a fictional character is just too much. So for those of you who have never read Old Yeller and for whom I've already spoiled the ending, let's take a look at the summary on the back of the book. When his father sets out on a cattle drive toward Kansas for the summer, 14-year-old Travis Coates is left to take care of his family and their farm. Living in Texas hill country during the 1860s, Travis comes to face new, unanticipated, and often perilous responsibilities in the frontier wilderness. A particular nuisance is a stray yellow dog that shows up one day and steals food from the family. But the big canine who Travis calls Old Yeller proves his worth by defending the family from danger, and Travis ultimately finds help and comfort in the courage and unwavering love of the dog who comes to be his very best friend. Out of the classics we've looked at so far, this one easily has the best summary, and it was also the easiest to find since I didn't have to go searching through the bowels of the internet to find it. It was actually printed on the back of the book. Praise the Almighty, they remembered what that space on the cover is for. I'm going to give this summary a very generous 4 out of 5, just because I'm so happy that they were able to introduce the main characters, the conflict, and the setting all in one go. Honestly, just the quality of the summary has me excited, and I'm very eager to see how the introduction for the story proper is going to go. So, let's dig in. Old Yeller by Fred Gibson. Chapter 1. We called him Old Yeller. The name had a sort of double meaning. One part meant his short hair was dingy yellow, a color we called yeller back in those days. The other meant that when he opened his head, the sound he let out came closer to a yell than a bark. I remember like yesterday how he strayed in out of nowhere to our log cabin in Birdsong Creek. He made me so mad at first, I wanted to kill him. Then later when I had to kill him, it was like having to shoot some of my own folks. That's how much I come to think of that big yeller dog. He came in the late 1860s, the best I can remember. Anyhow, it was the year Papa and a bunch of other Salt Lick settlers formed a pool herd of their separate bunches of steers and trailed them to the new cattle market in Abilene, Kansas. This was to get cash money, a thing that all Texans were short of in those years right after the Civil War. We lived in a new country, and a good one. As Papa pointed out, the day that he and the men talked over making the drive, we had plenty of grass, wood, and water. We had wild game for the killing, fertile ground for growing bread, corn, and the Indians had been put in the reservations with the return of the U.S. soldiers to the Texas forts. In fact, Papa wound up, all we lack having a tight tail hold on the world is a little cash money, and that we can get in Abilene. Well, the idea sounded good, but some of the men still hesitated. Abilene was better than 600 miles north of Texas hill country we lived in. It would take months for the men to make that drive and then ride back home. And all that time, the women folks and the children of Salt Licks would be left in the wild frontier settlement to make out the best they could. Still, they needed the money, and they realized that whatever a man does, he's bound to take some risks. So, they talked it over with each other and with their women folk, and decided it was the thing to do. They told their folks what to do in case the Indians came off the reservation, or the coons got to eating the corn, or the bears got to killing too many hogs. Then they gathered their cattle, burned a trail brand on their hips, and pulled out on the long trail to Kansas. I remember how it was the day Papa left. I remember his standing in the front of the cabin with his horse saddled and his gun in his scabbard and his bedroll tied on the back of the cannel. I remember how tall and straight and handsome he looked with his high-crowned hat and his black mustaches drooping in cowhorn curves past the corners of his mouth. I remember how Mama was trying to keep from crying because he was leaving, and how little Arliss, who was only 5 and didn't know much, wasn't trying to keep from crying at all. In fact, he was howling his head off, not because Papa was leaving, but because he couldn't go too. I wasn't about to cry. I was 14 years old, pretty near a grown man. I stood back and I didn't let on for a minute that I wanted to cry. Papa got through loving up Mama and little Arliss and mounted up his horse. I looked up at him and he motioned for me to come along, so I walked beside his horse down the trail that led under the big live oaks and past the spring. When we got out of hearing of the house, Papa reached down and put a hand on my shoulder. "Now, Travis," he said, "you're getting to be a big boy. While I'm gone, you'll be the man of the family, and I want you to act like one. You gotta take care of Mama and little Arliss. You look after the work and don't wait around for your Mama to point out what needs to be done. Think you can do that?" "Yes, sir," I said. "Now, there's cows to milk and wood to cut and young pigs to mark and fresh meat to shoot. But mainly there's the corn patch. If you don't work it right, or if you let the varmints eat up the roasting ears, we'll be out of bread corn all winter." "Yes, sir," I said. "All right, boy. I'll be seeing you this fall." I stood there and let him ride on. There wasn't any more to say. Suddenly, I remembered and went running down the trail after him, calling for him to wait. He pulled up his horse and twisted around the saddle. "Yeah, boy," he said. "What is it?" "That horse," I said. "What horse?" he said, like he'd never heard me mention it before. "You mean you're wanting a horse?" "Now, Papa," I complained, "you know I've been aching all over for a horse to ride. I've told you time and again." I looked up to catch him grinning at me and felt foolish that I hadn't realized he was teasing. "What you're needing worse than a horse is a good dog." "Yes, sir," I said, "but a horse is what I'm wanting worst." "All right," he said. "You act a man's part while I'm gone. I'll see you get a man's horse to ride when I sell the cattle. I think we can shake on that deal." He reached out his hand, and we shook. It was the first time I'd ever shaken hands like a man. It made me feel big and solemn and important in a way I'd never felt before. I knew then I could handle whatever needed to be done while Papa was gone. Let me tell you, I have a real soft spot for narrators that actually sound like what they are. In this case, the narrator sounds like a kid. A young kid that's trying to sound grown up. The phrasing of those first couple sentences indicates the main character is probably looking back on this from several years down the road, but he doesn't talk like an adult when we see him saying goodbye to his dad. The man is Papa. And his little brother isn't just Arliss, like his name is, he's Little Arliss, probably because that's what his parents called him. I was about 12, maybe 13, when I realized my mother's name was not Mama. I really struggled with that, even though I'd known for years that they were people, and people had names, just like I did. But the idea that my parents were anything but Mama and Papa was beyond the abilities of my young brain to grasp. But that essence of being a child, that feeling of not being prepared for all that's about to happen, that's a subtext and a quality of narrative voice that's just not easy to achieve. I think I've seen 2 other really good examples, both of which are dog books, now that I think about it. Shiloh and because of Winn-Dixie, both of which I'd love to dig into at some point. In addition to the excellent narrative voice, which lets us get to know the narrator even if we don't get to see him from another point of view, we have the excellent introduction of the world and the major conflict at the same time in his description of why his father has to leave, because cash money is necessary and this is the best way to get it. I've talked a lot about the promises an author makes in the introduction of their story. This book makes a promise with the very first line, and that is fantastic. We called him Old Yeller. In that one line, the center of the story is established. This is a book about a dog and the boy that loves him. So even though we almost immediately wander off into why Travis's dad has to leave, we have that promise to hold on to that this is a story about a dog, not a story about a boy who wants a horse. To wrap this up, I want to add just one more observation here. There's just so much to dig into in this book. It's this. There are several lines in this opening section that show us Travis is trying to grow up, or rather, you know, trying to already be grown up. He doesn't want his father to see he wants to cry. He's 14 and nearly a man grown. He makes a deal with his father, a man's work for a man's horse. This is a boy who desperately wants to earn his father's respect and be a man like him, tall and strong and handsome, maybe with nicely groomed black mustaches. That is a promise too. This is a story about Travis growing up. And between you and me, I really love coming of age stories. They're some of my absolute favorites. So I might be showing my bias here, but I'm giving this introduction a whopping 5 out of 5 because it successfully introduces all three main parts of the story, the main character, the setting, and the major conflict, and it has plenty of interaction between the main character and others, so that even though we never see the main character from anyone else's point of view, we have a really good feeling about who he is. That's all I have for you this week. The random question of the day is, what music or YouTube video can you play on a hard day that makes things feel a little less overwhelming? Until next time, stay safe out there, my Inklings. It's a crazy world, but we'll get through it all right. This has been your host, Inkfire, and you have been a wonderful audience. I'll see you on the other side. Thank you for listening to Catawampus Readings. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. If you're interested in supporting Catawampus Readings and would like early access to new episodes, you can sign up to donate monthly at patreon.com/inkfire. Special thanks to our patrons, Corvus, Valkyrie, and Barry Marie. Which Lessa... Sissus. Ugh. Too many S's.